ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hello and welcome to The Country Hour on this Friday afternoon. Brooke Neindorf with you. Coming up, irrigators have expressed confusion and frustration over the listing of the River Murray from the Darling River down as critically endangered.
I do not want the farmers that have gone through so much pain of water reform to have it apparently be for naught.
We'll have more on that story very shortly, but love to hear from you. What did you make of that announcement yesterday that the River Murray from the Darling River down will be listed as critically endangered? You can send me a text on 0467 922 783. But first today, in some breaking news, the Department of Primary Industries and Regions SA, or PIRSA, has declared a Queensland fruit fly outbreak in Elizabeth East in Adelaide's northern suburbs and is urging residents in the affected area to follow quarantine requirements. To find out more, we're joined by Director of Plant and Invasive Species Biosecurity, Nick Seckham. Nick, can you tell us a little bit more about this Queensland fruit fly outbreak?
Yeah, Brooke, unfortunately today we've had to declare another metropolitan outbreak of Queensland fruit fly, and that comes after we checked traps in the region earlier this week and found four fruit flies in traps within a 1 kilometre distance, so that's a trigger with an existing fly that we had there to declare an outbreak. So unfortunately, because this one, it is a metropolitan outbreak, but because we have to put in a 15-kilometre suspension area around it, that does bring in some of those growers on the northern Adelaide Plains as well.
Is this the first time this area has been declared?
It's the first time we've had one in this particular spot at Elizabeth East, but your listeners might remember that last year we actually resolved an outbreak that was at Salisbury North. And so that's a few kilometres away. We know that was separate, and that was resolved back in December. And similar situation there, the 15-kilometre ring around that one also brought in some of those Northern Adelaide Plains growers. So unfortunately, it's only a few weeks ago that we actually collected some additional traps and certification books from those growers, and now we're meeting with them again today about having to manage this new outbreak.
How many sort of growers will be affected, you know, in that sort of area?
Oh, look, we know that in South Australia, the number of particularly tomato and capsicum growers does go up and down a little bit every year, but it's somewhere around 200 growers in the state. And as to how many are in this zone, we'll have to do the maths on the new boundary, but it'd be quite a few dozen growers that are inside that new 15-kilometre zone.
We hear fruit fly, but it can affect other stuff away from fruit as well.
Yeah, that's the thing about Queensland fruit fly, unfortunately. It's got a really broad host range. So on that Northern Adelaide Plains region, we're obviously worried about things like tomatoes and capsicums and chilies. But it also affects in the backyard situation, things like citrus and in particular stone fruit, those soft fruits. It even gets into some things like, we know that rose hips and things like that can also be impacted. So it's got a very broad range of a lot of softer fruits.
What's the next step now, Nick, moving forward?
So we know from particularly these metro responses, it's really important to get going early. So our crews have already been out there and we're putting these organic fruit fly bait out, which we know works really well against these pests. They're attracted to it because it's food and it's organic, but it kills them quickly. So that's really important because they can turn over a generation really quickly within a matter of weeks. And so if we can knock that down really early, we can stop the subsequent generation. So that's the immediate task, is to get some baits out there as quickly as we can, and the crew will be working this weekend to help with that. Go through that process for a number of weeks to get the numbers right down, and then sterile fruit flies are what we use towards the end when we know the numbers have been knocked right down.
And in terms of backyard fruit and veggies as well, what should people be looking out for?
Yeah, we really do rely on people to help us out, particularly in these metro responses. So it's the same message as people would have been hearing for a while. It's really important to pick your fruit, check it, and if they see anything at all in there that might look like a fruit fly grub, there's other things that get into fruit, but anything wriggling around, we'd ask they ring our hotline on 1300 666 010, and we can make sure that if it is a problem, we jump on it quickly.
I'm speaking with Nick Seckham from PIRZA about this Queensland fruit fly outbreak that's been declared in Elizabeth East. And Nick, obviously school goes back very soon as well, so I guess keeping an eye on what gets put in lunchboxes too.
Yeah, so thanks for bringing that up, because, I mean, two things. First of all, fruit is absolutely safe to eat. We should be eating all of our, especially South Australian-grown fruit, because it's still completely safe to eat. In terms of school lunch boxes, if people buy their fruit at a commercial outlet, it's absolutely fine to still use it in school lunches and take it to school, because we know to get into the shops, it's already been certified, it's already been treated, or it's met the requirements. It's not affected by fruit fly. So people can still take commercially grown, retail sold fruit to school and to work for lunch, but we don't want to move around that homegrown fruit. That's where there could be a problem.
And you mentioned there before as well, looking at undertaking the sterile fly releases soon as well.
Yeah, that's the next step. So fruit flies, sterile flies work best when there are not many, if any, wild flies left in the environment, because they overwhelm the wild population and don't give them a chance to breed. So that will be a few weeks' time once we've had a program of putting out organic bait, so we can basically kill as many of them as we can and let the sterile flies do their job and make it as easy for them as we possibly can.
Nick Seckham, thanks for your time on the Country Hour today.
No worries, Brooke. Thank you.
Director of Plant and Invasive Species for Biosecurity with PIRZA, Nick Seckham. And to find further information and advice on that Elizabeth East outbreak, you can go to fruitfly.sa.gov.au. Now, lots of people in town here in Port Lincoln this weekend for Chinarama, and a lot of politicians amongst them for the event as well. And one of those is Minister for Trade and Investment and Industry, Innovation and Science, Joe Stockart, and who's been meeting with members of the seafood industry today. He's joined us in the studio today. Minister, thanks for coming on the Country Hour here today in the Port Lincoln studios. You're here for Chinarama?
Yeah, it's fantastic to be here, and always lovely to be beautiful Eyre Peninsula, and you know, so good to see Chinarama back, but also in a really good year for seafood exports. You know, it's been a really tough time for the seafood industry, and with no doubt, with you know, significant investment from the state government, from industry, to really promote that sense of buying local and consuming South Australian seafood. But the good news is that the world is still in high demand of our seafood, in fact, in greater demand than they ever have. And all of that really supports this really important industry for the EP.
In terms of tuna, what are you seeing there when it comes to exports?
So it's been a 5-6 year high. It's great news particularly out of course, Japan. You know, Japan continues to be the price setter for the tuna industry, a significant investment over many, many decades of collaboration. And that's exactly why just a few months ago I went to Japan and with the Southern Bluefin Tuna industry. And we went over there to really make the case for just how premium this product is, how important it is to the demands of Japanese consumers. And we had a bit of fun with it. You know, there's nothing as unique as the story of the Eyre Peninsula, of the farmers, of the fishers, and of our tuna. And I think, you know, what we've got to do well, and frankly, because if we don't tell our story of South Australia, no one is going to tell our story. So to be able to get to Japan with the industry to tell our story was meaningful. And it's great to see that the price has reflected that.
And to something like the Chinarama Festival being back, does that help as well? Because that's known around the world.
It sure does. And I have no doubt that the pictures of the foreshore and the tuna toss and of the industry coming together is going to be beamed over to Japan, particularly with the industry that knows the peninsula and the industry so well. You know, this is a long-term relationship, and it's a relationship built on trust. And you know, we are supporting the industry to continue to stay engaged with Japan, whilst also working really, really hard to open up new markets, you know, Southeast Asia, China, and we're seeing really incredible work from the industry here to open up those markets with our direct financial support. But the reality is that Japan is the number one consumer by a long way of the tuna that comes out of this region. It supports hundreds and hundreds of local jobs, and they love what they get.
And away from tuna, obviously, we've got so much other seafood here as well. What can you see for exports in 2026? Can you see them increasing even more?
Look, I do. And the reason I see it increasing more is a couple of things. There's a lot of work being done by our state government, by the federal government, by industry to continue to open up new markets. And what we've seen across the last 12 months is a record high of air freight. And the reason air freight matters to the seafood industry is that none of the seafood that leaves South Australia leaves in a ship. It's all in the bottom of a plane. It's chilled, and it has to get into market as soon as possible. And as a government and as a Minister for Trade and Investment, I've worked really hard to get more and more of these direct air flights into Adelaide. Next year, we're going to have the third largest city in the world, Shanghai, connected to Adelaide for the first time. We're seeing Hong Kong return, America through San Francisco, Dubai, Singapore and Malaysia. All of these things contribute to getting more of our seafood into market, competing and pushing out the eastern states. It's a big focus of ours, but we need to have that direct air freight connectivity. So as we see great results this year, I'm very confident that into 2026, we're going to continue to see that increase.
And we heard just recently that airline expansion has grown again.
It has. So since coming to government, we've seen a 40% increase in capacity coming out of Adelaide Airport. It's so important because, you know, not only do we have the best airport in the country, but as I lead these economic and trade missions across the world, whether it be Asia or Southeast Asia, China, United States and Europe, every single one of those premium restaurants, every single one of those importers tells me that the most important thing for them to get seafood from South Australia into market is time. And what we can see now, whether it be the United States, whether it be China or whether it be Europe, that we can get premium seafood from the Eyre Peninsula on a plane and into market within 24 hours. That's remarkable. But the reason it makes me happy and the reason it should be of comfort for the region is that it supports local jobs and it supports businesses to thrive.
It's sometimes quicker than what you can get here in Australia, 24 hours.
Look, and having spent a fair bit of time in planes in the last 12 months, probably some of those tuna get treated better on a plane than we do.
Now, while I've got you here, Minister, it was recently announced about this Trade Diversification Network. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, that's a great initiative from the federal government. And, you know, we're so well represented in the federal government from a trade and export perspective through Senator Don Farrell, a South Australian who we work really, really closely with. And this has been a new investment in the most recent federal budget to bring together the peak organisations around the country to work collaboratively to grow new and diversified markets. And we're backing that in with our own $5 million investment here in South Australia. We've announced a few parts of that already, wine, seafood, etc. But what we will be doing is co-designing these programs with the federal government and with industry. There is absolutely no doubt that the world is in a lot of strain at the moment economically. Tariffs have disrupted global order. We're seeing war and conflict prevail. What we need to do is support industry to do exactly what they do, and that's work really hard. And what they should expect from their government is that we work just as hard as they do. And that's what I'm trying to do personally as a minister, and what our Malinauskas Labor government is doing is investing that $5 million in collaboration with the feds to really get some rubber on the road, hold market access, and to grow new markets where possible.
We've got the Abalone Council of Australia, Southern Bluefin Tuna Industry Association and Seafood Industry Australia, just some of the members of this new network. I guess, you know, and we'll hear from them down the track about their involvement. I guess, what are you hoping they can bring to this network?
You know, what South Australia brings uniquely is the Team South Australia approach. And whether it's the bluefin tuna industry, whether it's the seafood industry, whether it's oysters, whether it's abalone, all of them are deeply committed to working collaboratively with each other. They work extraordinarily collaboratively as an industry. And they also work collaboratively across that sort of that best foot forward approach as a state. And as we do our work as a government and as I do my work as the trade minister, whether it's tuna, whether it's premium oysters, whether it's abalone, whether it's our wine from, in fact, just down the road at Boston Bay Wine, Siltikal. All of these things contribute to our unique story, our premium story, our sustainability story, and our connected story. And that's really important globally, and we've got to tell it, because as I said before, if we don't tell it, absolutely no one else is going to.
Minister, thanks for joining us in the studio today. One last question, though. Are you going to be tossing a tuna?
Look, I'm pretty cut up about this. I've got to get back to Adelaide a bit earlier than I was expecting, so I'm going to have to pass it in this year, but I'm going to be back with a vengeance next year.
All right, go home and practice.
Thanks.
Minister, thanks for your time on the Country Hour today.
So good to be with you.
Minister for Trade and Investment and Industry, Innovation and Science, Joe Sokach, with us there on the Country Hour here in Port Lincoln today. Brooke Neindorf with you. You're listening to the Country Hour. It's 20 minutes past 12.
Each weekday at noon, tune into the Country Hour.
European breeds thrown in, the mixed simmental and the odd black Angus. It's a bit of a fruit salad.
The Country Hour.
Food of the gods.
Tune in weekdays at noon on ABC Radio and on the ABC Listen app.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, with the state election only around 60 days away, the promises are starting to flow in from different parties as they look to secure votes in different electorates. And as I mentioned, there are a lot of politicians here over the next few days to do with Tunarama, but also to meet up with locals. In the seat of Flinders here in Port Lincoln, opposition leader Ashton Hearn joined local member Sam Telfer to make a $12 million promise to the local seafood industry. And they explained to Emma Pedler what will be involved.
And it's something which is vital, not just for the present, but for the future of the fishing and aquaculture industry. The Service Wharf Marina, so the marina area where we see that fishing fleet tied up and unloading their wares. I think that's one of the unique parts about Port Lincoln, is tourists come in and see operational fishermen coming in, unloading their product that goes straight to market. And that wharf area has been degraded. It's been calling out for investment. The city council have been asking the state government to be responsible for their aspect of it. It's a unique arrangement there. So an elected state Liberal team under Ashton Hearn's leadership will be investing $12 million to upgrade that wharf area and to make sure it's suitable not just for now but into the future.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be standing side by side, Sam, on making this massive commitment for Port Lincoln but also for the Eyre Peninsula more broadly. This is something that Sam has been speaking to the team about for a long time, and his advocacy. Without it, he's done a fantastic job in making sure that the team knows just how important this is, and we're really delighted to be coming to Port Lincoln and making this significant investment.
The $12 million, what will that cover?
So it's that area of interaction between the boats and the wharf area. And if you go down
like
that area,
loading zone,
it's a pretty challenging space. And fishermen and seafood operators have been telling us all the way along, it's becoming unsafe because of the amount of product that's being unloaded, and it's also degraded to a point where the interactions between the boats on the water and the infrastructure on the land is dangerous as well. So yeah, it's in overdue for an investment, and this is why, in recognition of that future looking, it's really important that this investment happens. And you know, this is something I've been asking the government to do as well. It's something the city council has been proactive in trying to advocate for a strategic investment for a long time, and it's really important that it happens.
That was local member Sam Telfer in the seat of Flinders, and also opposition leader Ashton Hearn speaking with Emma Pedler about a $12 million promise to the local seafood industry for a marina and wharf upgrade if they get in after the election. Now, irrigators have expressed confusion and frustration over the listing of the River Murray from the Darling River down as critically endangered. The listing announced by the federal government yesterday means major new developments with the potential to affect the area's ecosystem would need to be assessed and approved under environmental law. SA Murray Irrigators Chair Karen Martin says she believes the listing isn't accurate.
Initially, I'm angry. I'm not super happy about it, and I question its validity. This has been tried before and has been declined before by the Parliament. I think it's gross neglect from the EPBC committee that made this recommendation. They are some of apparently the most eminent scientists and ecologists that our country's got, and they are declaring that post-Boson Plan, post-water reform, post-peak salt of the 80s, that we're now worse than we've ever been. So all of the economic commitment that multiple governments have made apparently led us to a critically endangered point, which is just simply not true. There have been gains. There has been positive things in the environment that have occurred, and our investments haven't gone to waste. And I think that's the contempt that this listing does. It's not the first time they've done it. They do it by stealth right before caretaker mode in the past. This time around, they've just got the numbers in the Parliament, so we'll just ram it through. And I'm angry about that. This is not the first time it's come up, and it is wrong. We are not critically endangered here in Renmark, and certainly to blanket something as a collective from the Darling down, complete insanity and in no way best available science. So,
what does this listing mean for irrigators?
Well, most of our members own farms, either on the floodplain or above the floodplain in the Highlands. We've had to deal with Selindi zoning policies, we've had to deal with land policies, etc., and water reform. And this just puts further policy layers and more cost impost and the potential to not be able to do on your farm what you need to be done to run a viable business. And that creates a very real sovereign risk issue, which I hope that the government has taken into account.
So there's a lot of uncertainty for farmers then?
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. And it's also bad timing and in bad faith, because we are about to have the Murray-Darling Basin Authority release to the community for consultation their review of the current basin plan. So for this group to come in and make that kind of declaration before the community has seen what the authority have worked towards is holding us all in contempt. And I mean, do they think they're bigger and better and above? Do the authority know this? Is it worked into the current plan that we're about to receive in less than a month that we've all been waiting a long time for? So things like that are just muddying the waters. They're holding us in complete contempt and it's wrong.
Have you heard of other environments being listed as critically endangered before?
I mean, under the EPBC Act and under environmental rhetoric, there is a hierarchy of threatened, vulnerable, seriously threatened, into right up to what is critically endangered, which is apparently one step before endangered, dead, gone. Now, that's why I say it's not correct. I mean, I could handle threatened or vulnerable or critically vulnerable, but certainly not critically endangered. And that holds policy implications and development implications, not just for irrigators, but for wetland structures, for councils, for anybody and everybody from the Darling down. It's terrible.
So far, the information that we've received from the federal government is that it wouldn't impact any current arrangements in how people, I guess, work and live along the River Murray, but any sort of future developments that might impact. You know, what sort of things could that impact?
I mean, that's not dissimilar to saying to people back in the 90s that hex increases won't affect you. And then fast forward 20 years and they're dissolving debt because it was a monumental failure. So these things are a slow creep. Yeah, okay, that sounds good on the surface, but you try to change one little piece of infrastructure on your farm, you try to upgrade a wetland wetting and drying structure, you try to do absolutely anything, including pipelines to everywhere, you're going to be hit with more cost, more time impost, and more bureaucracy, and more chance, sovereign risk, of them saying no to quite literally everything in the name of something. And that holds a very real financial risk to farmers, and it holds a real financial risk to pretty well everybody.
And I guess, what questions do you have for the government that, you know, that you need answered to provide people with certainty about this announcement?
Well, firstly, I'd go directly to that committee of the EPBC group that advised that it was critically endangered. This is in no way true. I'd like them to substantiate that data. I'd like to see how and what sort of surveys have you done out here on the floodplains. Did you just cherry pick one little salt affected area? Or did you look at what is working, what did work, how the extra flows that the basin plan has recovered and that the Commonwealth Environmental Waterholder currently owns are doing good? I think this constant doom and gloom scenario to try and push through policy that is highly unpopular is just a pattern that just keeps occurring, and here we are.
And so, you know, at the same time, the federal government's trying to provide $20 million in grants for the Sustainable Communities Fund, and one of those activities is to help people transition crops. But I guess, how could people then transition crops if that might be under this environmental legislation?
And to live in the real world, it's a complete oxymoron. If somebody in a financial world or an advisor anywhere said to me, you're one step away from dead, I wouldn't say go and invest your money. It's a complete contradiction. And not true, because you should invest your money. You should come to the Riverland and check out tourism. You should enjoy the countries that have improved because of basin plan flows and tooth flows. And I do not want the farmers that have gone through so much pain of water reform to have it apparently be for naught.
SA Murray Irrigators' Karen Martin speaking with Eliza Burlarge on the banks of the River Murray there in Renmark yesterday. Brooke Neindorf with you, and let's find out what's happening in the weather. We're joined by Simon Timke at the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Simon.
Hi there, Brooke.
What's happening around the state?
Look, a pretty quiet day today. We've had quite a bit of cloud down over the southern districts of the state, and there may have been some very isolated light showers about sort of windward coasts and ranges in a south to southeasterly airstream. We did see a little bit of light shower activity yesterday, and a couple of spots picked up to around a millimetre or so. The wettest was Mount Lofty with 1.4 millimetres. Pandana and Longwood both picked up 1.2. Cleve even picked up a millimetre in that southeasterly airstream. Mount Barker and Crape is also picking up a millimetre. So some low totals around the place, but generally not terribly widespread at all. Further north, clear skies right across the state, across the Pastoral and Flinders District. And that cloud in the south, we're starting to see it breaking up somewhat over some areas. So probably increasing amounts of sunshine over southern parts of the state during the afternoon. The winds generally south to southeasterly direction, probably freshen up a bit during the afternoon with sea breezes near the coast. Over the next couple of days, remaining pretty much dry. I think dry conditions right across on Saturday. The south to southeasterly winds will persist, and we'll see again some fresh, maybe fresh to strong sea breezes near the coast during the afternoon. Temperature-wise, it's getting a little bit warmer out in the far west and near southern coast, but elsewhere I think below average, so not getting too hot for this time of year. On Sunday, there is a trough moving across. It's not going to produce a lot of weather for SA, I don't think, but we might see the chance of a shower or thunderstorm about the lower southeast on Sunday, most likely late afternoon and evening, I think. It will be a bit warmer ahead of that trough. We'll see a little bit of northeasterly wind there, which will give us some maximum temperatures a little bit higher on Sunday. So a bit of a warmer day. But then on Monday, we will see those maximum temperatures drop a little bit again. And weather-wise, again, dry over most of the state for Monday, but there is a chance that we could see some isolated showers and possible thunderstorms about the eastern agricultural districts on Monday in behind that that trough. So the more northerly winds will persist about central and eastern parts before the winds turn around more southerly following that change. So we'll see those southerly winds extend across western parts on Sunday and then across central and eastern parts during Monday. And once those southerlies push across, again, we'll see maximum temperatures take a little bit of a drop following that wind change. On Tuesday, dry conditions returning right throughout the state, maximum temperatures pretty close to average for this time of year, I think, for Tuesday in that southerly airstream. As far as cumulative rainfall totals go out to the end of that four-day period ending Tuesday, generally not much about the place. We might see some totals getting up to less than 2 millimetres in those showers in the onshore airstream that I talked about. Might be a little bit wetter in some parts about the lower southeast. We might see some falls of 2 to 5 millimetres about that area. And with thunderstorms about those eastern agricultural areas, we might see some isolated totals of 2 to 10 millimetres. So a little bit out there, but really not too much to speak of as far as rainfall totals, Brooke.
No worries. Thanks, Simon. Have a good afternoon.
Thanks a lot, Brooke.
Simon Timke at the Bureau of Meteorology. Let's have a look at the Western Inlands now. For the Upper Western, a sunny day with a chance of a thunderstorm in the southeast in the late afternoon and evening. Winds south to southwesterly, 15 to 20 kilometres per hour. Tending south to southeasterly, 15 to 25 kilometres per hour in the early morning. Overnight temperatures falling to the low 20s with daytime temperatures reaching the mid to high 30s. For the Lower Western, mostly sunny day with a chance of a thunderstorm in the late afternoon and evening. Winds southeasterly, 20 to 30 kilometres per hour. And overnight temperatures falling to between 17 and 21, with daytime temperatures reaching the mid-30s. Brooke Neindorf with you. It's 27 minutes to 1.
The 2026 Australian Open. Hear it live and ad-free on ABC Sport Digital and take it with you on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Thanks for your company on the Country Hour today on this Friday afternoon. Still to come, if you're coming to Port Lincoln this weekend for Chinarama, you can get involved with helping set up a local oyster reef.
It's just as fitting that we can use these reefs to redevelop fish habitat, to create more structure for fish and other marine critters, of course, to come in and inhabit those spaces and lay their eggs.
We'll have more on that story shortly, but I also want to hear from you as well. We've been hearing a lot about Tunarama because I am here in Port Lincoln and I can see it happening right outside the studio window. But what is SA's best local event? Or maybe Broken Hill? Let me know, what is special about your town's event? Send me a text on 0467 922 783. Just like Sean from Mount Gambier has done, I think he's talking about the river situation here. He says, "Hi Brooke, if everyone keeps taking a sip out of the glass, strangely, the bottom of the vessel is empty. More population, more farming, less water into the river." Thanks, Sean, for your text. Let's get the latest from the newsroom now. We're joined by Matt Coleman. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Brooke. In the news this afternoon, the chair of SA Murray Irrigators has questioned the listing of the Lower River Murray as critically endangered. The listing was announced by the federal government yesterday and covers the river system, its wetlands and floodplains. Chair Karen Martin does not believe the listing reflects the entire Lower Murray system and says it presents more challenges for irrigators during an already hard time. A Marion Bay fishing charter operator says he's seeing discoloured water and an abnormal amount of sea foam along beaches of the tip of York Peninsula. According to the state government's algal bloom website, the latest test results for the region are pending. Charter operator Ryan Valenti says people are cancelling their bookings and his fuel costs have increased as he operates in deeper water to avoid the bloom. And a former senator says getting details about how much GFG Alliance owed the government in royalties was like extracting teeth. The ABC can reveal the former Whyalla Steelworks owner owed $18.5 million, which the government said it could share now that the company is in administration. It was revealed after questions about FOI documents obtained by Rex Patrick. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thanks very much, Matt. Matt Coleman in the newsroom. Now, just to let you know that we just received a release of four to let you know that flood recovery works on the Stuart Highway at Lake Windabout are complete. In early 2022, intense rainfall and subsequent flooding caused extensive damage to sections of the Stuart Highway, disrupting travel and the transport of essential supplies and services. And these remediation works occurred in an area approximately 150 kilometres north of Port Augusta and included raising the road level and incorporating new drainage structures to enable this 1.5 kilometre stretch of the highway to withstand and remain open during flood events. And erosion protection has also been installed to boost flood resilience and strengthen the road pavement and shoulders to prevent washouts and deliver safer, more reliable journeys in the state's far north. And the state government has said that these completed works will enable the road to return to functionality sooner in the aftermath of future flooding events and reduce the economic impact of disasters and connecting regional communities with more resilient infrastructure. And the Stuart Highway runs for almost 1,000 kilometres through SA and links Port Augusta to Darwin. And on average, 900 vehicles, including 300 heavy vehicles, travel through that area each day. And in cooler months, traffic volumes along this stretch of the highway can peak at 1,300 vehicles, with one third of these as heavy vehicles as well. So interesting there to see. Great news that that has now reopened. Now, it's been a few months since Varroa destructor, commonly known as varroa mite, was discovered in South Australia. So what's next for the pests management? And what do we know about how it got into the state? PRSA Chief Veterinary Officer Dr. Sky Fruin explains where varroa has spread so far.
We've now got detections of varroa mite in 16 sites. Those sites are all linked to one pollination event at Gumaraka. So that hasn't changed. We haven't had any sort of new detections that we haven't figured out where they've come from. And other than that, it really is just encouraging beekeepers to register, monitor their hives and get in touch if they have any questions.
So we did know, that, as you said, that Gumaraka spreader event, and that was a Coorong apiarist was there. Do we know how that Coorong apiarist got varroa in his hives to kind of start this spreader event?
So all of the detections from that event were linked to a pollination event in Gumaraka. So the hives were up in Gumaraka for pollination and then have been moved back down to Salt Creek. So the first detection was at Salt Creek. However, it's been picked up in Gumaraka. We've been able to figure that out.
Right. So he didn't necessarily bring it to Gumaraka. He caught it in Gumaraka.
Yeah, well, we're not sure the original source, so we still haven't determined the original source would have been from interstate, but we haven't been able to determine exactly how it's come in from interstate. But since that detection, we have been able to work out that all of those detections have been linked to that pollination event in Gumaraka.
So as you said, now things are looking pretty stable. How much longer is that expected to last for? As we've discussed before, there is a limited amount you can kind of do to stop the spread of varroa.
Yeah, so monitoring and treatment is really key. I mean, this is a pest that we will need to learn to live with and manage. There is no eradication program. It's a transition to management program. So all the efforts that we at PRRSA are doing are to support beekeepers to pick up the mite early if it is there, because that makes it a lot more manageable, and to provide sort of education and resources to help beekeepers to manage the pest once it is in their hives. So there's a range of things that can be done in terms of treatment if that's considered necessary.
I know there has been, you know, online events and opportunities for people to come and ask questions. Has the community been, you know, taking up those offers? Do you think they're pretty well informed, our group of beekeepers and apiarists in the state?
I think they're pretty well informed, and I think it's only improving. It's a little bit hard to measure engagement, but we have had a lot of interest in those events. One thing we have seen pick up in the last few weeks is people self-reporting, monitoring to the surveillance heat map that's on our website. So that's reporting whether or not they've found mites in their hives, so that beekeepers can do that themselves. They don't need to report through us. All we would ask is that if they do find varroa mite, that they do call PRRSA and let us know so that we can get in there and assist with surveillance and monitoring. But I guess the great thing about that heat map is it helps with telling where varroa mite is, but also where it isn't. And so it's really pleasing to see that beekeepers are appearing to be monitoring more frequently.
So what comes next? Is it essentially just more of the same, Skye?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, the intent of the transition to management plan that we're operating under is to support beekeepers to get used to living with varroa mite. So slowing the spread and helping them adapt their beekeeping techniques and the way they're managing their hives so that they can learn to live with this pest, because inevitably it will be here to stay in South Australia. That's accepted. We're just trying to minimise the impact on South Australian beekeepers now.
Yeah, as we've spoken with beekeepers and PRRSA, I think, previously about how, you know, coming into South Australia was always going to be inevitable. Within these first months, has that transition to management and what you've seen so far, is that kind of one of the better case scenarios than what you might have been prepping for in South Australia?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, just the fact that we've only got one spreader event is great. You know, it could have been possible that we were dealing with a whole heap of introductions from interstate and a whole heap of different areas. So it means that the impact it's obviously significant on the beekeepers that are affected. They are being supported as best we can to help them manage the pest, and it will spread further. It's just trying to minimise the speed at which it spreads and therefore the impact that it's having on those beekeepers. So I don't know that there's ever, it's hard to look at a best case scenario with a pest like varroa, but it certainly could have been worse.
So, of course, rightfully so, the focus has been on our beekeepers in South Australia, but if and likely as this worsens, there'll be effects for, you know, cropping, farmers, horticulture, different areas that might not be used to having to bring in bees that have relied on wild bees. Will there be information for those types of farmers that are kind of adjacent to this problem that don't necessarily have direct input with bees?
Yeah, so again, if you've got questions, please do reach out to PRRSA. I mean, probably the bee biosecurity email and the APRI team is your first point of contact, because they are the experts when it comes to bees and varroa specifically. But we also have a broader team, obviously, at PRRSA who can is here to help and support industry as best we can. So if people have questions about what varroa means for them and they're not beekeepers themselves, they can absolutely still contact PRRSA.
PRRSA Chief Veterinary Officer Dr. Skye Frewen speaking with Elsie Adamo. And to read more about the latest on the varroa outbreaks advice and to look at that heat map that Dr. Skye mentioned there, you can head online and search for varroa and PRRSA. And if you suspect varroa mite, contact the Exotic Plant Pest Hotline immediately on 1-800-084-881. And Andrew from Hope Valley has texted in and are still wondering if there's any advance with pseudoscorpions for dealing with varroa. I think you've asked that question before, Andrew, so we'll see what we can find out with that one there. Now, we've just had it come through as well from Emily Burke, our Minister for Infrastructure and Transport. The final remaining closed section of the Birdsfield track in SA is now open to road users following the completion of minor works near the Cooper Creek Causeway. And the reopening of this final 5 kilometre section will allow freight operators, locals and tourists to fully access the Birdsfield track in SA. And this development means that the use of the Cooper Creek barge is no longer required. So that barge, which was $27.4 million, transported approximately 13,200 cattle
and got them across to those markets. And a total of 760 vehicles, including 330 heavy vehicles and 1,295 passengers, used the barge during operations from early November 2025. And they've said that given flood events have historically occurred in consecutive years, that barge will remain on site in the immediate future as conditions of water coming down from Queensland are monitored. So that will stay there on site. So good news that it's no longer needed and those roads are open.
Sulugong to serve.
The ABC brings you the story of an icon.
Avon Goolagong.
I know. Want you to win.
Goolagong.
That's what I'm here for.
Stream all the episodes now on ABC iView.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Now, 6 years ago, if you stepped onto an Australian feedlot and it was a coin toss whether cattle had access to shade. Today, nearly three quarters of the nation's lot-fed cattle, about 1.3 million head, are now shaded. And it's part of a growing voluntary shift across the industry to shift livestock welfare standards. Brenda Long reports.
It's a warm summer's day in Australia's feedlot heartland, and Bryce Cam is looking over his animals. The grey and cream cattle stand in the sun, while the black and red stock huddle in the shade. Set above them is his latest project, 7 kilometres of shade cloth.
We're here on a warm day today. We're in front of a pen of 150-odd head here at the moment, and I would say the greater majority of the cattle are kind of lined up in the shade line that the shade's providing. There's others that are scattered out in the sun still. You know, the cattle genuinely, particularly on hot days, will take advantage of the shade.
His operation is near Dalby, west of Brisbane, where Mr. Cam has gone all in on shade at his family's feedlot. It's all part of a $3.3 million three-year project to protect around 25,000 cattle from the sun. Mr. Cam admits it wasn't cheap, but he says it's worth every cent.
We simply have a mantra that happy cattle are productive cattle. The investment in shade is, again, one of those elements in ensuring that there are industries meeting community expectations and looking after our cattle.
In 2020, industry body, the Australian Lot Feeders Association, or ALFA as it's known, launched its shade policy, encouraging all Australian feedlots to provide shade by 2026. That deadline has not been met, but according to their new report, three quarters of all cattle in Australian feedlots now have access to shade. That's about 1.3 million head of cattle, and it's a big jump from just 56% back in 2020. ALFA President Grant Gehry says the industry is still moving in the right direction.
Certainly from an industry point of view, you know, we'd like to see all cattle with access to shade over time, and we'll continue to work with lot feeders and do R&D to help underpin lot feeders continuing to install shade where they haven't yet got to do so.
That said, not everyone's convinced. Some feedlot operators argue the costs are too high or that shade isn't always necessary, depending on the climate or the breed of cattle. Andrew Knight is a veterinary professor of animal welfare. He says shade should be mandatory.
The fact that they don't drop dead always if they don't have that shade does not mean that they're not suffering.
While there are general state legal requirements for those in charge of livestock to provide sufficient shelter, shade for livestock is not explicitly mandatory. The Australian government has committed $5 million over 4 years to renew Australia's animal welfare strategy, with it due out in 2027. Professor Knight says current government positions are outdated.
I think their position is completely wrong. Current laws are obviously not adequate. It's consistent with a very old-fashioned and outdated animal welfare position, which is no longer considered reasonable or plausible or up-to-date within the animal welfare science world.
From an industry point of view, all this shade effort appears to be paying off. Consumer concern about grain-fed cattle has been falling steadily since 2013, with a sharp drop since 2021, according to research and development body Meat and Livestock Australia. ALFA President Grant Gehry says a big reason for that is the perception that cattle farmers are ethical and humane.
I think a lot of that's been driven by the focus of the industry to do things like installing shade and and making looking after the cattle and making sure the animal welfare's right in what we do every day.
Looking ahead, Alpha estimates that about 85% of all feedlot cattle will have access to shade by 2029.
That report by Brandon Long, and a spokesperson from the Department of Agriculture, Fisheries and Forestry, says that the Australian government has committed $5 million to the renewal of the Australian Animal Welfare Strategy, which will provide a framework for a national approach to animal welfare and bring key stakeholders together on animal welfare issues of national significance. Now, finally today, locals and visitors in Port Lincoln are being invited to help restore an oyster reef as part of this weekend's Tunarama Festival, which kicks off today. The 1 hectare reef is the first site of a statewide program to redevelop marine habitats and will be located between the city's grain silos and Brennan's Wharf. Marine ecologist Manny Catt says people will be able to learn about the marine environment as they drop bags of recycled oyster shells to build the reef over the weekend.
Yeah, so Tunarama is a really exciting opportunity to engage the Port Lincoln community. In particular, we happen to be in the seafood capital of Australia, and it's just as fitting that we can use these reefs to redevelop fish habitat, to create more structure for fish and other marine critters, of course, to come in and inhabit those spaces and lay their eggs. These reefs historically have acted as nursery habitats, and historically we've removed hundreds, if not thousands of kilometers worth of these oyster reefs across the state. And Port Lincoln was one of these areas that we have really high confidence that we had massive oyster beds in this region. And so we're starting off our statewide oyster reef restoration program right here in Port Lincoln. We've been doing a little bit of work in Coffin Bay, and that's been great. But this reef in Port Lincoln we're doing is the first reef that we're really doing to scale. So we're aiming to develop a hectare of reef. We're going to be putting it in an area that is accessible to communities. So it'll be right between the grain silos and Brennan's Wharf, the fishing jetty that juts off there. So people can go and fish off the jetties and effectively fish from these reefs that we're going to be developing there.
Is that why you chose that spot? Because it is perfect for, obviously it is perfect if you chose it, but that's
yeah.
So, was there other places you looked at?
So there's a handful of other places that we looked at. When it comes to picking a site, there's a few things we're looking for. One is the biodiversity and the amount of biomass that's in the area. Second is the suitability of the seafloor. So that area, there's a lot of seagrass in the area, and seagrass, Posidonia australis, it's incredibly important. We don't want to hurt that, but we do want to help stabilize the sediment around that seagrass. And there is a really large area of sandy seafloor that is suitable for deploying our shell bags, our reef units on top of. And the other really important factor is the presence of native oysters. So they're just under the jetty right there. We've been doing some diving and surveying, and there are heaps of hammer oysters, which are another oyster species we haven't really spoken too much about, but they're there. Used to also have massive hammer oyster beds all across the state. And there are also Angazi oysters under the jetty as well. And so it's in pretty close proximity to these small but existing oyster populations. And so we can utilize their spawning cycles to capture their spat, their larva, to repopulate those oyster populations.
So with Tunarama this weekend, how are you hoping that locals or visitors might be able to get involved or just learn a bit more about what you are doing?
So thankfully, we have partnered up with Cuddy's Glass Bottom Boat Tours, and Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, we will be running trips, about 45-minute trips on the hour, every hour from about 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., I believe, where people can come on the boat and actually participate in this reef restoration activity. So on every trip, we're going to be deploying a handful of our reef units, so people can help load up some bags and actually get to deploy these bags while we're on the trips and learn about these ecosystems and actually see what's down there and see and learn about what the benefits of doing these practices.
And for people, if they're thinking about doing it, do they have to get in the water to get involved? Or how do you set the oyster shells out there?
So we've been tinkering a bit, and we've had a trap door installed on the glass-bottom boat. So the glass-bottom boat has effectively three separate viewing windows. We've taken out one of those windows and put in a trap door so we can pull a lever and whoosh, away the reef eggs go.
And they just sort of settle themselves in those spots?
Yeah, so we can configure them on the boat in the position that we want them, and then because we have a full view of the seafloor, we can ensure that we're dropping the bags in suitable spots and in the, I guess, position that we want them. And then they, yeah, effectively just sink down and into place, which is pretty fun to watch.
And how is the collection going of oyster shells that you need for this kind of project?
Yeah, so for these reefs, we need a lot of shell. And just as of last month, we've acquired our oyster shell recycling center, our facility to actually acquire all the shell and to wash it, clean it, bag it up. So that facility will be open to the public pretty soon. We'll actually have volunteer days where people can come out and participate in putting these reef units together. And we're now working with a lot of the oyster farmers in Coffin Bay. Thankfully, we have the largest supply of oyster shell in the entire state right here on the Eyre Peninsula, right in Coffin Bay. And so it's only fitting that we put a recycling center next to all the oyster farmers. And yeah, we've got a bunch of them on board. They're bringing their shell over, depositing it, and yeah, it's going really well. So, and we're also working with a handful of the local seafood suppliers and oyster wholesalers around Port Lincoln and Coffin Bay. Shout out to the Fresh Fish Place and Oyster HQ, Experience Coffin Bay as well. So a few of the local tourism operators who have anything to do with oysters or oyster tourism are helping support this project by donating their shells.
So if you're having a few oysters this weekend at Chinarama, potentially they could end up in this reef.
Oh, absolutely. We'll have a bin out at our booth. We're going to have a booth set up. We're going to be in stall 28, just in Market Lane. So come find us, say good day to us, and we've got some university crew coming over, doing some live demonstrations at our booth, and yeah, come out for a spin on the boat and check it out and see what it's about. And once the reefs are built, go for a fish and hopefully catch some more fish on these reefs. Big thank you to the oyster industry. Big thank you to the local seafood industry and to the community for getting on board and helping support these projects. And ultimately, you know, this is, in the grand scheme of things, this is just the start. We're planning on doing a lot more. Over the next 3 years, we're going to be developing 25 reefs across the state. And, you know, if we can build a bit of a movement around this, it won't end there. We'll continue to develop these reefs and build more habitat and hopefully build more resilience along our coastline. And yeah, I think that's just really exciting. So the more support we can build for this, the more reefs we get and the healthier oceans we get.
Marine ecologist Manny Katz from Eyre Lab. And if you are heading to Chinarama this weekend, you can find out all about the Chinarama program all online, or just head down to the foreshore as well, and you'll see Manny and his team down there. Now, I put the call out for, you know, events in your town that are pretty cool. Izzy's text in. She says, Melrose Show. Used to love collecting a show bag and seeing all the art, photos and baking that people had entered. Josh has said, no longer my town or region, but the running of the sheep down the main street in Barmara during the sheepdog trials is a sight. And Laura has said, the dinghy derby, which is weird and wonderful, and people come from everywhere for it. So thanks very much for texting in and letting us know about those events. Now, we've just had it come through from Minister for Primary Industries and Regions, Claire Scriven, has said that a team of experienced SA biosecurity field staff will be deployed to Victoria to support the response to the ongoing bushfires by helping assess livestock injured in the fires. And the Department of Primary Industries and Regions veterinary and animal health officers will work alongside Agriculture Victoria and other agencies on the ground. They'll assist impacted livestock owners and provide expert assessment of injured animals, and where necessary, humanely euthanise injured livestock livestock to ensure high standards of animal welfare are upheld during this difficult period. And the deployment of up to 10 PRRSA staff will look at those arrangements there between states to share expertise and resources during significant emergency events. And the PRRSA staff will assist with, as I mentioned, conducting detailed welfare assessments of livestock affected by fire, advising farmers on humane treatment options, and that helping with euthanasia where animals are too badly injured to recover, and liaising closely with Victorian authorities and producers throughout the response and early recovery phase. And the PRRSA staff are, in addition to approximately 150 SA firefighting and incident management personnel that have been deployed in recent days to help respond to the multiple uncontrolled bushfires still burning across Victoria. And this includes personnel from the SA Country Fire Service, SA MFS, Department of Environment and Water, SA Ambulance Service, SA and SES, and Fraser Fire and Rescue. So well done to everyone that's headed along to Victoria to help out there. That's what we've got time for on the Country Hour today. Cassie Huff will be back with you on Monday. It's coming up to news time. It's 1 o'clock.
The ABC Listen app lets you take ABC Radio with you wherever you go. At home, in the gym, up a ladder, on the road,
interstate,
outer space? Download the ABC Listen app today.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.